In 1824, Ludwig van Beethoven completed his final symphony, Symphony No. 9 in D minor. Universally considered Beethoven's greatest masterpiece, the piece and its composer played an integral role in the transition between the classical and romantic eras in Western art music. Beethoven's Ninth, also known as Ode to Joy, later fills the pages of Christian hymnals around the world as the song, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. This work of art, famous for its uplifting and hopeful melodies to congregations for centuries, stands in stark contrast to the tormented artist who created it. So now experience pianist Jay Hinson's modern take on a timeless classic.
Thank you. Beethoven wrote and completed the Ninth Symphony in 1824, and it's universally considered to be his greatest work. In fact, many consider it one of the greatest compositions in the Western musical canon. Yet, why does no one argue that Beethoven wrote and composed this piece? Well, it's because we have the proof, right? We have the score. Randy today is addressing the question, is the Bible God's word? Randy will take you through a series of factual truths of why we believe, without question, that the Bible is God's inspired word. So please give your attention to Randy Pope.
You know, I have a feeling that if Beethoven could have come back and witnessed this, he would have said, that was a lot better than the way I did it. So that's really good. I always look forward to that one. That is a good one. Well, welcome to all of you. We're glad to have you here again today. I don't know how many of you are first-timers, but if you are here for the first time, I would highly encourage you, if you would, to go back and listen to our podcast. And you can get that on perimeter.org/ifanswers, I-F-A-N-S-W-E-R-S. So that would be a great help to kind of understand where we are and what we're doing. I will give this a bit of background to what we're doing. We're looking for a place, I think most of us that are in the searching mode of figuring out Christianity are looking for a place that is safe, enjoyable, and brief. And that's what we're trying to provide, a place to investigate the claims of Jesus. Now, in doing so, last week I made the comment that most people who are theists, meaning they believe in God, if you're a theist, you do want to investigate. I'm just finding theist after theist says, yeah, I don't want to be on my deathbed and say I've never investigated the claims of Jesus if I think there's a 10% chance that Jesus could be who he claimed to be, God himself. And so it's just logical that we're needing to find a place that we can do that, and one that can be done briefly. It is my opinion that for there to be a good investigation, you have to look at least a handful of questions and determine what you believe to be the answer to those questions. And then once you determine if you do or you don't believe the answers to these questions, as Christianity would suggest, then you want to be in line with whatever your answers are. For instance, if I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, as I said, I think a person would be a fool not to follow him. If we thought that he was not who he claimed to be, then we would be a fool to follow him. So we need to find a place to investigate. What are those questions? Four questions, I think, that are the most critical questions. Number one, how can Christians believe the Bible is God's word and that it's without error? I mean, think about it. First of all, how could it ever have been? And if it was, how does it remain in a condition that could be accepted as accurate after these many, many, many years handed down, generation after generation after generation? Seriously, how can Christians believe that at all? That's question number one. Question number two is the question of how can Christians believe that all people, including more religious people outside of Christianity, deserve to be separated from God forever? That just doesn't square with logic. It just seems like that's unfair. Then the third question would be, of all the religious leaders that have ever lived, how can Christians say that this Jesus is the one and only way to find relationship with God? Now, that just seems to be awfully narrow. The last question, and I think only if you found merit in the answers to Christianity's thinking about those first questions, you'd then want to ask, well, what does Jesus say is required to be in favor with God and to have life forever in heaven? What does he say is the answer to that? So we are, for these 4 weeks, beginning this week, we're looking at the first of those questions. By the way, next week, we'll be looking at what I think is the most important of all questions. It really is, because here's where most of us are going to have the hardest time, I think, looking at the data and understanding and embracing. And that is, how can Christianity believe that all people, including more religious people outside of Christianity, deserve eternal punishment. And what's going to go right hand in hand with that one is, how can a loving, good God let so many bad, horrific things happen to good people who are gracious, kind, people that we look at and say, what a wonderful person, and look at the hell they're going through. If God is God, why does he allow that to happen? So we're really hitting the toughest of all questions, I think, next week. So we'll look forward to that time as well. Now, the three components to a morning together here. The first, after we introduce it as we have, I'm going to spend a few minutes addressing the question of the morning, as we'll call it. Number two, we're offering to each of you to take one of these copies of the Gospel of John that are our copies that we've taken the Gospel of John and added questions in the margins. And then we're taking five chapters per week. There are 21 chapters, so the last week, obviously, there'll be six. But we're asking everybody to read through the five chapters, look at the questions. There's probably six, seven, or eight questions that you'll see in the margins throughout the five chapters. And just as you read the question, immediately across from the question will be where the answer is found in the text. And we would encourage you, use that to stimulate your thinking to understand what the Gospel of John is saying. And I'll go through and take some of the questions each week that I think are most pertinent to give you a better understanding of what's being said here. Then the third and final portion of our time will be an open question time. You can be asking your questions by text. You can ask them by email. And can we put those up? Ask questions now. There's the text number and the email. ifgod@perimeter.org, and then 678-829-8879. So you feel free anytime during our talk here. Just be typing out a question, throwing it up. If you would, we would prefer that you would actually ask them from the audience. If you wouldn't mind us putting a microphone in your hand, that way anybody can hear the questions. It's looking online to follow up on this. Okay? So that's kind of how we're going to be doing this. Now, the question for the day, how is it that Christians can believe that a Bible written that many years ago could ever have been, and then even if it was to remain, an infallible word from God? How could we believe that? Well, I want to share six realities that I think make it reasonable to believe that the Bible is God's word. Now, I do not have it as my intention. I'm going to state this again and again. It is not my intention to try to persuade you or talk you in to believing what I believe and what Christianity believes. That's not my job. What I'm here to do is to give you a very appropriate representation of Christianity, to give you data to help you to investigate the faith of Christianity. That's it. So my feelings don't get hurt if you challenge and you say, I disagree with you. I think your answer stinks. I don't believe at all. I think this is a bunch. I go, well, good. I just helped you investigate. You can come to either conclusion that it is or it isn't the real faith. That's all we're trying to help you do. And I always say, hey, I can be wrong. Anybody can be wrong. None of us have perfectly put it together and have all the answers. So just use this as an opportunity to hear something that I think appropriately and fairly represents Christianity, and then make your own decision, okay? So let me give you six realities that I think might help you at least be convinced that Christians do not shelve their brains to believe that the Bible is God's word without error. So you've got an insert, or a piece of paper there that has the outline on it. I'm going to encourage you to kind of follow the outline. I'm going to put in a total of eight quotes up that will be helpful to go beyond just what I'm saying. I don't like to read too much, but they're brief quotes, but I think they'll be helpful in the process. So utilize that kind of as an outline as we walk through this. Here's going to be the first of six realities. The Bible's historic reliability. It is a reliable doctrine. Lewis Marcus, he is an apologist. for the, actually, I'm sorry, he writes the apologies for the 21st century. This is what he says. He says, in order to substantiate the basic claims of Christ and the essential doctrines of Christianity, the apologist, that's somebody who is defending what they believe, need not prove the inspiration or inerrancy, inspired means God breathed, inerrancy means without error, of the Bible. He need only to show the Bible to be reliable in its account of Jewish and Christian history. So, if you were to look at the dates, places, people, and storyline of the Bible, you will find that they are incredibly accurate. That's just a point. It is a reality. Archaeological discoveries are proving over and over and over the realities of the Bible in terms of history, dates, and so forth and so on. Archaeologist William F. Albright, this is how he puts it. I'll put it up. Discovery after discovery has established the accuracy of the innumerable details and has brought increased recognition to the value of the Bible as a source of history. So just from an accuracy viewpoint. A renowned Jewish archaeologist, Nelson, and I think it's Gluick is the way you say his name, he says this, it may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. Scores of archaeological findings have been made which confirm in clear outline or exact detail historical statements of the Bible. And, by the same token, proper evaluation of biblical descriptions has often led to amazing discoveries. Oxford historian A.H., and I think it's Sauss, I'm not sure, Sauss or Sauss, says, time after time, the assertions of the skeptical criticism have been disproved by archaeological discovery. Events and personages that were confidently pronounced to be mythical have been shown to be historical. And the older writers have turned out to have been better acquainted with what they were describing than the modern critic who has flouted them. Extra-biblical writings, another very important thing. I'm going to later come back to a very important writing of one who's not writing scripture, but wrote as a contemporary to the time of Jesus, just right at the time of Jesus. His name, Flavius Josephus. But I'll say what Dr. Jeffrey Brashears writes, very intriguing, very respectable person, Jeffrey. Viewed merely as an ancient text, it would be regarded by all serious and honest scholars as probably the most reliable historical text of the ancient world. So, just the historical reliability, and the first quote we made, I think is an important one to think about. You know, you don't really have to prove that the Bible is inerrant and all this stuff. You don't have to prove that to give it warrant of credibility if you can say it is an accurate description of history, the events of history, and so forth. So let's look, number two, at the Bible's scientific reliability. Brashears writes this way. Not only does the Bible support modern cosmology, including an instantaneous creation and the constant expansion of the universe, but it did so more than 3,000 years ago in stark contrast to all other ancient cosmological theories and long before Moses and other writers of the text would have known the truth about such a phenomenon. Indeed, the Bible describes features of the universe that would not be discovered until recent times. The knowledge is only explicable in terms of supernatural revelation. Doesn't prove anything, obviously. Now, you realize that science is now admitting that there is an outside power to start the universe. That was just recently that's come up, that now they're saying, well, it has to be an outside power. Used to, well, maybe there was just this, that, and the other that existed somehow, and then this happened. But now they're saying, no, there has to be some source of energy or power that made this happen. There's no evidence to show living creatures reproduce outside their own kind. Agnostic scientist, Stephen Jay Gould, this is how he writes. Species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they finally disappeared. I like to think of it this way. Get away from the quotes for a minute. I like to think of it this way. People are always asking me, well, what about the issue of creation evolution? That's the big one. I remember a man that I was meeting with, And it happened to be that some buddies of mine who were good friends of this man named John, and said, I want you to get with this guy. I want you to meet with him. And he's a challenging guy to Christianity. I mean, he just really is strongly opposed to Christianity. But would love for you to get to meet him and know him. He said, would you play golf if we can get a golf game together? I said, sure. So we meet to play golf, and they put me in a different cart so it wouldn't be too suspicious and he wouldn't be too anxious, you know. And so we play 9 holes. We get through the 9 holes. We're at the break. We're just grabbing something to drink and about to head out to the 10th hole. And he says, hey, you mind walking this next hole with me? And I said, no, I'd be happy to. He says, good. He had his big cigar, and he's just strutting down. He says, you know what? I don't like these hellfire and brimstone churches that exist. You know that? I hate them. I said, well, I could understand that kind of statement. I said, kind of tell me, what are you talking about? Why you bring that up? He says, because your church is a hellfire and brimstone church. I said, really, you think our church is a hellfire and brimstone church? He said, I know it is. I said, how do you know that? He said, I've been there before. I came one time, and it was hellfire and brimstone. I said, well, I'm really not sure, you know, why you would think that. I'd love to have that discussion if you ever be open to having lunch. I'd love to talk. He said, I'd be happy to have lunch. So we meet for lunch. And so I had the opportunity to show the little diagram that I showed last week. And he got enamored. He said, hey, I'd like to meet with you for 4 weeks. I don't buy Christianity at all. And I said, why do you not buy it? He said, for one simple reason. It's a proven fact. Science has proven evolution. And the Bible, I know, it says the world was created. Okay? I said, well, that's an interesting discussion. Do you want to talk about that for a few minutes? And he said, sure. And I said, after I shared a few things, but I said, you know why I personally believe that there's a creation instead of an evolution? And I gave some data and scientific facts to kind of help support the thought. But I said, you know the big issue for why I don't believe? So why not? I said, because there's no such thing as design without a designer. You think about that. I took my iPhone out. I said, you see this iPhone? I said, imagine that we were 100, 200 years ago, and this thing was laying there on a beach near the water. And you pick this thing up, and there's no such thing as electronics as we know it. Nothing like this. And all of a sudden, you pick this thing up, and you look at it, and you go, wow. And you hit a button, and a picture comes up, and numbers up at the top, and you realize it's the time of day. That is amazing. You hit another button and there are pictures coming up over it. And you go, wow. But no one anywhere, nowhere, could ever come up with a reason that this thing could exist. No one claims existence, nothing. But you find it and you look at it. What is the likelihood that you would ever say, you know what, that thing just came into existence over time, washed up from the water somehow, and here it is. And then I was able to share some detail about the human cell. And before long, his mouth was falling wide open. I said, you know what? This little phone, it doesn't compare to the human body. And no comparison whatsoever. Now, in my opinion, when I see design, I have to believe there's a designer. He said, I ain't buying. I'm not buying. I said, well, good. That's your business. That's the best I can offer you, so you've at least investigated a little bit. And he wanted to meet 4 weeks to investigate, so we go through our time together. We get to the end of 4 weeks. He said, this has been one of the most helpful things I've ever done. Very good. But he says, I don't buy any of it. I said, well, that's your business. Your business. I don't know if it was a month or 2 months later, I get a phone call. He was on international business travel. And he calls me, and this is what he says. He says, Randy, I'm sitting on my balcony looking at one of the most amazing mountain ranges in the world. And I have to tell you, I just gave my life to God. And now I know there has to be a designer to create this kind of design. Doesn't mean he's accurate. Doesn't mean it's right. But now you talk to this man passionate about the things of God. And he will tell you, you know what the big issue for me was? I didn't want to believe it. That was the bigger issue. But I think we open ourselves up. We have to say, okay, what about this whole thing about design? I say all that because I know many of us here go, well, if the Bible's wrong about one thing, it's wrong about anything. And that's the one that so many capture and say, I know it's creation or evolution, therefore I have to dismiss the whole Bible. Don't jump there too far. One other thing, if I can say about the creation issue, I would say this to many people. I've asked the question, have you ever read one or perhaps two books from a very intelligent, reputable scientist who is a creationist who tells why they're a creationist? Have you ever read such a book? I have yet to meet one person that I'm talking to in this, not that there aren't people that have, certainly I know there are, but I haven't met any yet who have already read two reputable ones or two people that are fighting for the realities of what they believe. And I say this, I may be wrong. I don't believe that when you read their books that you would necessarily become a creationist, but I'll tell you this, I think you would have incredible suspicion about your own views of some kind of evolution. I think you'd all of a sudden say, wow, I did not know all that stuff. So I would encourage you, if that's an issue for you, you might want to read some, and we can help you get the right things to read if you're interested in something like that. Let's look at the next, number three, the historicity of the resurrection. Now I'll come back to this Flavius Josephus. He was a Jewish priest and historian. He was a noted historian. You can go to the university systems today and you will hear Flavius Josephus, highly respected and quoted, the author of The War of Antiquities. Many of you are familiar with that writing. And this is what he said. Now, I put some underlined in here because there is some thought that maybe it can't be proven that this was in the original. The part that's not underlined, there's no debate about it. It says, about this time, there lived Jesus. By the way, he was not a follower of Jesus. Keep that in mind. About this time, there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher as such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Christ. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing amongst us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day, he appeared to them restored to life, for the prophets of God had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him. And the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. So there should be no debate. This is just a historical writer that everyone seems to, you know, and he lived, I think, 20 or 30 years after the time of Jesus. So it was the same general timeline. And so there should not be debate about the reliability of the person that there was a Jesus who lived, and this was his statement about him. The other important, I think, thing to add to the historicity of the resurrection, you had these disciples that were so committed to following Jesus. But once he died, they were beginning to scatter. There was like a fear component that they were showing some real issues of question. You might know the account of Peter and what happened when he denied Jesus three times. But it's after the resurrection that everything changed. And now the historical record, not biblical record, but the historical records that we have give evidence to most all, if not all, of the apostles or the 12 disciples, as they're called. They died a martyr's death. If they had not believed in the resurrection, I think they would have said, all this is off, guys. Hey, this whole thing was presumed upon that he was God. And no evidence now. He's still a dead man. But there was none of that. So just an important point. Number four of our six, the Bible's united theme. Just to put it this way, 1,500 years, the Bible record spreads over that amount of time, 40 authors, from three different languages, different continents and cultures, but the absence of contradictions. Now, again, I know that some people are going to say, oh, I'll show you some contradictions, but I'm not saying that there are no contradictions. I don't personally believe there are. It doesn't mean there are none. But when I hear people who tell me over and over, but what about all the contradictions of the Bible? I love just saying to them, bring the, to our next lunch when we get together, bring one or two of those contradictions and let's look at them. And I've had some brought to me that I go, ooh, that's a good one. I don't know about it. But as I go and research and study, I come back with something that certainly, you know, convinces me, whether it convinces them or not, I don't know. But I just say this, all of these contradictions that we always hear about are a lot more talked about than I think reality. Number five, the Bible's fulfilled prophecies. There are over 300 prophecies in the Old Testament referring to Jesus when he would come, including this. And this is over hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus. He would be born in Bethlehem. His descendants would be a descendant of David. He would be a descendant of David. Betrayed. He would be betrayed by a friend. He would be sold for 30 pieces of silver. His hands and feet would be pierced. He'd be crucified with thieves, and he'd be buried in a rich man's tomb. Amazing that many different 300 such as these that told about this person, Jesus, and what would be happening before he was ever even born. The mathematical probability, I was a math major, and the mathematical probability is incredible. It would be taking 8 with 17 zeros after it. I don't know if you have any idea how much that is, but I'm going to put it this way. As a mathematician, it's a lot. It is a lot. All right. Number six, the Bible's manuscripts preservation. Many of you have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the 1947, the leading discovery of any amount of biblical literature at one time. And the oldest manuscripts prior to that time dated back to the 9th century A.D. Now, that's 900 years, all right? So we don't have manuscripts back to the earliest days, which is going to be the last thing I want to address. But we have now, 1,000 years prior, the Qumran scroll discovery dated 1,000 years earlier. So that's a lot of difference there. All but Esther was found in all these various discoveries. And it is virtually a duplicate of what we have today. Now, in one chapter of the book of Isaiah, 166 words, they had one fragment with that, only one word was changed. It was three letters within the word that didn't change the meaning of the text whatsoever. So there were some alterations, which says, ah, I don't care, there are some alterations. So you say it's an errant word. How do you describe that? Before I answer, let me at least tell you this, that if you take other ancient literature, such as literature from Plato, 1,200 years later, we have 7 manuscripts. Nobody doubts that it's his. Aristotle, 1,400 years later, 7 manuscripts. The New Testament, same general time period between 1,200 and 1,400 years later, 14,000 manuscripts. And so the number of manuscripts, amazing. So here's what I would say before we get into the other questions. But if I were to try to describe, well, how can you Christians say, or answer the question, how can you Christians say that this Bible written so many years ago could still be accurate today? Here's how it works. I'm going to put one mark up here, and that mark is going to represent what's called the autograph, all right? The autograph is the first writing of the book. There's 66 books in the Bible, Old and New Testament combined. That says there are 66 autographs. With me? We have none of the autographs. Ah, that sounds to be a challenge to the Christian faith. Well, we don't have any, so you can't show the original. So how do you know that anything that came after the autograph could be accurate? Well, first of all, I can't say why there are no autographs. Why did God let the autographs remain? My best judgment says this. If there were autographs, the Christian community would build shrines. They would be worshiping it. All kind of bad things would be happening that God would hate. But I don't know the reason, but there are none. But here's what happened. This particular autograph would then be copied, let's say three times. So I'm going to put three lines here, meaning the copies, okay? Those three copies are transcriptions. Transcription. They're just taking what they have and they're copying it. The people that did this were called scribes. Scribes literally means copyist. Their job was to copy. You hear about the scribes and the Pharisees when you read through John. Scribes, that was their original job, was to just transcribe. Now, once they would do that, it would take a long time to be able to do these three. You know why? Because there were the laws of the scribe. And I'm going to just make this up to make it simple, to make the point. If they were trying to copy and it said, the boy went to the store, and that's what they had to copy, they would do, not this, but this is the idea. They would do T-H-E, 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 and then they would see E-H-T, 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 B-O-Y, B-O-Y, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, and then T-H-E-B-O-Y, T-H-E, and then they had to go back. The law of the scribe was just, I can't imagine anybody doing it. I mean, can you imagine doing that all day? But that was their job. And the law of the scribe was so detailed that it was to keep any mistakes from ever coming in. Well, would there still be mistakes? Yeah, either by accident or by people who say, I want to change this, and some bad scribe gets in there. So yeah, there's going to be some alterations that come along. But then this one was sent to another community, and a scribe there would do three of it, and then three of it, and then three of it. And this just keeps going on and on and on and on and on, keep going and going and going and going until we get down to modern time. So now we have these, as I'm going to say, 10,000 copies at a particular time. And we look at these copies, and now we've got 10,000? Wow, a lot of copies. So we look at those 10,000, and we say, how many of them are identical? And we find out that there are 900, let's say, and 20, just to make a number, 920 that are identical. But there are 80 that are called variant readings. You with me? Variant readings, meaning they're alterations from the other 920. And so instead of, let's say it's John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son, whatever. There were, let's say, 20 of them that said God so loved the Jew that he gave his only begotten son. Well, that's a variant reading. It might be another 20 that say God so loved the Gentile that he gave his only begotten son. Or maybe it was, I don't know, a different word somehow. But it adds up to be 80 different variant readings. So as I studied Hebrew and Greek, you would know that in the Greek and Hebrew Bible, you could look over the margin of certain study Bibles, and you could actually see variant readings. And it was given a grade, A, B, C, or D. A lot of variant readings, very few or whatever. And then you can go further and look and see what are the variant readings if you really wanted to study it. But the idea was, let's figure out what this originally said. And so if a Christian tells you they believe the Bible is God's word and without error, you can challenge them correctly and say, you're saying that you believe the autograph is infallible without error, and that through a scientific process, we can be convinced what that original said because we can now look at all of these variant readings. And the good news is, where there are variant readings, they are so minor, they are so insignificant, and that's what the Dead Sea Scrolls showed. In fact, everybody was like, wow, 1,000 years. We're jumping up now 1,000 years in time. Now we're going to see all of how it's all changed. And it blew everybody away. Oh, there were a few, but they were little variant readings. And so, if there is a God, could God preserve his own record? Well, if he's God, yes. But now the bigger question is, do we believe Jesus is who he claimed to be? Last thing on this. Jesus could only look back to the Old Testament. Jesus believed in the authority of the Old Testament because he quoted it as God's truth. That's important. he thought it was. So now we can take the study to Jesus and say, do we think Jesus is who he claimed to be? That's why everybody I meet with, I say, look, what I'm going to help you do is really answer one question. Do you believe Jesus? Remember the three? Liar, lunatic, or Lord? That's really your decision to be making. And again, if you think he's a liar, lunatic, you're a fool to follow him. And it's your call what you believe. But if you truly believe he's who he claimed to be, the Lord of the universe, then we'd be the fool of fools not to follow him. And that's what happened to me when I said, I got to find answers. I want to see. And I go, hey, I've become convinced. Can I be wrong? Yeah. But I'd be a fool not to follow what I truly, truly believe. So let's keep that all in perspective as we do our evaluation. Okay? Good enough. Now, we're going to have time for some questions on that and anything else, but I want to go to this Gospel of John for a quick minute. Let's look at a few of the questions. I'm just going to look at four of the questions that are in there and give you a quick answer. Now, again, we're just looking at the first five chapters.